Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Russell King. I'm the one of the developers on the Arm Linux project. As you may know, there are various projects springing out of that at the moment. One of them is the NetWinder. And I'd just like to talk this morning about what's actually in the kernel for ARM support. And although I can't go into the depths of how you port the kernel, because I don't know what hardware you could be porting it to, I can tell you what structures are in there already to allow you to port to different architectures, different machine architectures. So, the first question is, what is ARM? ARM is a 32-bit RISC processor. It comes in two varieties. One of them has been phased out quite some time ago, which was a 26-bit address bus processor. The later ones are all 32-bit. The reason that I'm mentioning the 26-bit is that they do still have some bearing on how ARM Linux developed. Originally, when I was porting Linux to ARM, started off with an old Acorn A5000, which has in it one of these 26-bit processors. That meant that because you had a reduced addressing range, you had to squeeze this 4 gig address space that you have on the PC down to like 64 megabytes, which wasn't very easy to do to fit everything all in. But I won't spend too much on that because that's all in the past and the chips are no longer available. However, there have been recently an explosion of machines using ARM Linux. We've now got the NetWinder. We've got a in-car MP3 player called EMPEG. We've got the ITSI, the EBSA 285, the EBSA 110. In total, I believe that there are in excess of 14 different machine architectures running ARM Linux. So that gives you an idea of how big it is. The processor support, the support for the ARM machines is broken up into two different sections. You've got support for the actual machine hardware itself, and you've got support for the actual processor hardware. This structure was adopted because in some of these machines the processor plugs in on a card. So you could have an ARM 610 processor in an Acorn RISC PC, or you could have an ARM 710 or a strong ARM processor or whatever. With that, that meant that Linux had to cope with these various different processors. Each different processor has got some variance as to what caches it has on it and the precise instructions and so on and so forth, bits and pieces like that. By the way, if anybody's got any questions, just interrupt. As I said, RISC, ARM is a RISC processor architecture. The market originally used to be desktop machines. The ARM processor came out of Acorn Limited, Acorn Computers Limited, in the UK. They basically were, after improving their BBC Model B and Master hardware, with the goal of make basic run as fast as assembler. I think that it's quite possible that they did actually achieve that over the older machines. However, as they progressed, they split a separate company off called Arm Limited. And although they don't actually make any hardware, they are responsible for the intellectual property of the Arm chips. And they produce this wonderful manual called the Arm Architecture Reference Manual, which I think that some of the Arm programmers really, really hate. It's quite a good reference, so long as you bear in mind that you can't always trust it. But over the years, Arm developed this processor, and it went from an 8 megahertz clock up to 25 and then 36. 35, thank you. And then they started farming it off to various companies. They gave people like Digital Equipment and GC Plessy licenses to manufacture the Arm chips. That is basically how Arm Limited make their living, by having all of these licenses with all of the chip manufacturers. As I say, just to repeat, the 26-bit address space ARMs are now obsolete, so I won't be spending very much time on them at all. The 32-bit address space processors are the ARM6, the ARM7, the strong ARM, so on and so forth. Those are the core processors, which are at the heart of every ARM device. Around that, they add to it things like memory management, caches, onboard peripherals, and so on and so forth. So you end up with a chip called the ARM7100, which has extra cache and memory management and all that sort of stuff that you need to make the processor run faster. But there are different ARM7 core devices, like the ARM7100, which is used in one of these. It's a GeoFox. It's a Cyan 5 clone, effectively. It's got an ARM7100 in, running at 18 megs, and it seems to be quite reusable. It runs off two AA batteries. And it's capable of running off those for 19 hours. The other one that I'll highlight here is the strong arm. There's two major strong arm chips around at the moment: the SA110, which is the chip that's used in the Netwinder and the Episode 285. And the SA1100, which I believe is used in the ETSI and the Visual Aid. Yes, Visual Aid. And also, excuse me, also the, it's also used in, never mind. No. I think the Sun 5 is a 7100 again.
It's the 5, they changed the chip to a 5 MX.
Did they?
In 5 MX, it's still a 700.
Anyway, going back to the caches. The caches aren't as useful as they are on the x86 architecture. Pat was talking about this amazing feature that Linux has to map a single page into multiple regions and be able to get, I think it was about 88 nanoseconds through the whole, through reading a megabyte's worth. Unfortunately, that doesn't work on the ARM because the cache is not a physically indexed cache. That means that if you've got, say, three pages mapped, which are the same physical page, one after each other, and you read all of them, the cache has to load out of the RAM for every single location. So it may be the same page in all three places, but you end up with not a 4K chunk used of the cache, but a 12K chunk. So you don't gain any extra speed through mapping the same page in multiple times. The memory management structure on the ARMs is similar to the x86 architecture. It's still a two-level page table. It's not as nice as on the x86. The level one page table, which is the top level one that describes, if you like, the high level mappings, is 16K in size, which is four pages. It must be 16K aligned, and that does sometimes cause problems with Linux. The actual page tables themselves are 1K in size, whereas on the x86, both levels of the page table are 4K in size, which is quite convenient because it does mean that you can just get a single page and you've got yourself a page table. Going back to the ARM, the second level page tables contain page permission bits, cache control bits, and various implementation defined options. The page permission bits are capable of saying, okay, we want this page to be read-only. We want it to be read-write. We don't want the user to be able to access this page. So it doesn't strictly have a read permission and a write permission. You can't tell the user space that you only want to allow writes to a page, which is sensible because you would never, I think, want the user to be able to write to a page and not read from it, because otherwise it's sort of like dev null. The cache control, in with the page table entries, are usually two bits. One of them is a cacheable bit, the other is a bufferable bit. The cacheable bit means that if you're trying to access data in this particular page, then the cache may access the data for you and then give you the data, and so it gets loaded into the cache. If you switch that bit off, then any access to that page will go straight through into the real memory. And with searching the strong arm, when the processor needs to access the external memory, it has to slow its clock down, because typically the core is running at something around about 200 megahertz, maybe 275, maybe 287 if you're really daring. And when it needs to access memory, the external bus is only running at about 66 megahertz maybe. So the core needs to be slowed down so that it can synchronize with that. The bufferable bet, on the other hand, is to do with writing. Yes.
What are the non-coherent passions?
Non-coherent. Yes. Sorry, I skipped that. Non-coherent cash basically means that I'll first of all explain what a coherent cash is. Coherent cash is what you've got on the x86. It means that if you have a bit of cache data sitting in there and you've got some other DMA operation going on, say, to the same bit of memory that you've got already sitting in the cache, then it will either access the cache instead of the main memory, if it's a read, or if it's a DMA write, then it will update the cache. Right? On the strong arm and most of the other ARM processors, the cache is non-coherent, which means that that updating does not happen. So you can end up with a situation where you've accessed some data through the processor, it's loaded into the cache, you go off, do a few other things, you then start some disk I.O., it reads in a page which, unfortunately, you've got some data cached in that page. And if that's read in using DMA, the physical memory is updated. The processor, though, still has this data, the old data, in the cache. So when it goes to read that memory, it reads the cached version, not the updated version. So there's special handling in the ARM kernel to deal with that, and we'll be looking at that later. There are, in the these other bits in the page tables, which are implementation defined. Let's give an example of this. The ARM6 processor cores have an updatable bit, which means that you can say to the processor, okay, I want to cache this region of memory, but I don't want to update this cache if I write to it. That was put in there because Acorn decided that when they designed their machines, they would typically have a ROM area and the code executed directly from ROM, and shadowed behind that were a set of registers. So they allowed you to write to the ROM area, which was marked as cacheable, and if you allowed the cache to be updated when you wrote that, you'd update the cached copies, which you don't care about really, because it's ROM, it doesn't change. Moving on, we've got the idea of domains in the ARM processor. The ARM processor's got 16 domains in there. Each domain can be set in various different modes. You can have a domain which is no access, so there's no way for any process, whether it's in supervisor mode, privilege mode, or whatever, to access that memory. You can also have it set up as manager, which allows global access to the memory, irrespective of what the page permission bits are saying. And you can also have a client mode, which is where the page permission bits are actually used. That does have its uses. Initially, the guys who used to be using ARM with the Acorn machines were saying, well, what's the point of that? We can't see any use. Well, I put it to some use in Linux. It's used to control the access to the kernel memory, which I'll be describing later. The ARM does have some peculiarities to it as well. The alignment of the data types is quite critical, and I know that some of the NetWinder guys have done some work to get around some of these problems. The problem is that because the machine is a 32-bit machine and it's RISC, they don't do anything to deal with a case where you're trying to load 32-bit but it's not 32-bit aligned. So you can't go loading 32 bits from, say, address 2. Well, you could do, but you get some very interesting results happening. Instead of loading 32 bits being the bit naught starting at byte 2 and ending at byte 6, it instead gets byte 2, byte 3, byte 0, byte 1. It rotates it, in other words. So that is actually, that behaviour is put to good use by the compiler, which causes other problems. But nevertheless, there is a way around this on the 32-bit processors. You've got an aligned exception handler, which can switch on. As soon as you do that, if it's trying to access a 32-bit word, which isn't 32-bit aligned, then the memory management says, kernel, please do something about this. And typically the kernel goes away and says, well, what was the instruction? Oh, it was a store of 32 bits to here. Okay, we know how to handle that. We write this half word and this half words out to the memory, or something like that. So we get around that problem like that. There are variances in the instruction set between all the ARM processors. They aren't that bad. It's not like you've got some processors which have these sets of instructions and these later processors don't have them, so you've got to work out some way of generating code that fits all of them. That doesn't happen. All ARM processors implement a subset of the instruction set. For instance, the ARM2, which was the second ARM, the first one that appeared in machines, though, the instruction set on that is more or less the basis for all the upwardly developed processors. So you could take, in theory, a bit of ARM2 code and run it on a strong ARM. No problem. And in fact, Linux does do that, or used to do it. It depends what distribution you've got, really. But on some machines, it's capable of modelling the old 26-bit environment. The other thing about the ARM processors is that they have no floating point. I know that quite a few of you have been using the netwinders in the small room over there. I think that some of you may have noticed this when you've been trying to play MP3 files. You find that you're using MP123 and you get bursts of music. That's because there's no floating point. And the floating point, therefore, has to be done using software emulation, which is slow. There are some ARM chips, though, that do have floating points on. There's one, the ARM 7100 FE. Excuse me. And that's got a certain amount of floating point instructions, but there's never been, as far as I know, any ARM processor which has a full complement of floating point instructions. Generally, if you've got a processor which has some floating point support in it, it'll implement the easy things like add, subtract, multiply, divide, that sort of stuff. But anything like sine, cosine, and logarithms, and so on and so forth, the things that require you to do multiple operations to work out what the result is, those sorts of things are still emulated in software. Another issue that ARM has is, as again Pat mentioned in his lecture, that the first page, first virtual page, must not be used for user programs. The first page contains all of the various vectors for calling the kernel, including interrupts, including page faults, and such like. So that page is very important to stay there. If you lose that page, the machine generally just stops dead. Right. Currently supported machines in the kernel are the Acorn Archimedes, which is the very first machine which used the ARM processor, which was publicly available. The A5000, which is the machine that I initially ported ARM Linux onto. The RISC PC, which is this 32-bit machine. That came out in about 92, 93, 94. And while Intel, well, Digital were developing the strong ARM, they did various evaluation boards, the EBSA 110, which they kindly sent to me, and got Linux running up on that in a couple of months. EBSA 285, again, that is similar to the NetWinder. It's an evaluation board, though. So it's basically a card which contains an ARM processor, a PCI bridge, and a PCI bus. And then you can plug whatever PCI cards you want in it. A couple of other ones that you may have seen on Intel or what used to be Digital's websites are Brutus and Ditsy. There's various others like Nexus PCI, Chalice Cats, which is another PCI device. The NetWinder, of course, we've all seen them now. Sun 5, the GeoFox, which I showed earlier, and EMPEG, the in-car MP3 player. Just so that you can see the two evaluation boards, I've got a couple of pictures of them, the insides of them. It looks a mess, but what do you expect for an evaluation board? It's got the ARM processor. You may just be able to see it. The ARM processor is there. It's sitting in a socket, so you can take it out, replace it with some other ARM some other strong ARM processor. Got the usual two SDRAM banks, a couple of bits of glue logic, PCMCIA on it, Ethernet, and Super I/O. EBSA 285. That's what my one looks like. The actual EBSA 285 card is this one here. And that contains all of the host bits and pieces, like the host bridge, the strong arm, and flash, and so on and so forth. And going across a 3COM Ethernet card, a Promise UDMA card, S3 video card, and an ISA type bridge card. Right, okay, so moving on to, you want, maybe you don't, but maybe you do, maybe you want to port Linux to a new machine, which has an ARM processor in. I suppose the first thing to do is to try and get hold of some documentation if you haven't got any. After all, if you don't have any documentation, you don't know what's there. And if you don't know how the machine's connected up, you don't know what the address space is, and so on and so forth. However, you can go some way to guessing what that structure is by having a look at the chip numbers on all the devices. You can usually identify the ARM processor without any problems. You can identify if it's got a PCI bridge or something like that on. And if you get the data sheets on those, then you can say, oh, okay, it's probably connected up like this. And then you can try writing bits of code to verify your assumptions. But the best way to do it is to get documentation on the actual system itself. The next thing that I'd advise is try to get the ARM Linux sources. You never know. Somebody else may have already ported it. Or what would be even better is that somebody has already ported it to a similar machine. That exact situation happened when Corel did the NetWinder, because they started off, I believe, with the episode 285. Yes. NetWinder used the same PCI bridge as the episode 285. So, in effect, a NetWinder is just an episode 285 with different PCI hardware plugged in, but in a much smaller case. But yes, you can get the sources for ARM alerts. You need to get the kernel off Linus, which is, of course, the FTP kernel org address. I only ever release patches to his kernels. In general, at the moment, you always need to get a patch from my site. So far, there has never been an ARM kernel in Linus's releases, which you can just take his release and build. Hopefully that should be cleaned up in 2.3. Hopefully. There are a variety of other patches available as well. The SA1100 stuff currently isn't in my kernel, but there are patches around that Nick Pitter has produced, which I've now got, and they should be going in shortly. And that covers everything from EMPEG to the visual aid device that I think he lent a hand in developing.
I have one here, so if people want to see it after the conference, I would be pleased to do some demonstration.
For those who didn't hear, he's willing to give you a demonstration of it if you want after the lecture. Unfortunately, I had a few problems with the fonts on this machine, so I said if the process, because of the way the architecture is split up, you've got separate processor support from the actual machine architecture. So that really makes your life easier. You can say, I know that this has got a strong ARM processor on, so I don't really have to think about, do I have to modify the kernel to get it working on the strong ARM, because somebody else has already done that. And all of the processor support is quite modular. As I said earlier, you can get machines with ARM 610s in, ARM 710s or strong ARMs, but they're the same hardware in the actual machine. Similar thing is used for the actual machine hardware. It may just be, in the case of the NetWinder and the EBS 285, that you just need to reconfigure the kernel slightly differently. Hey presto, you can run it on the NetWinder. It's not quite that simple on the NetWinder, but today, essentially, that's all you have to do. And as I said there, if for whatever reason you have a new processor or a new hardware, then you have to start looking at actually writing some code. I do hold a definitive list of supported architectures. Every architecture is assigned a number, which allows the kernel at runtime to say, OK, I'm running on an EBC285 or I'm running on a NetWinder, therefore I don't want to execute these bits of code, but I do want to execute this. One good example of this is the LED code. The LEDs on the NetWinder are different from the LEDs on the EBC285, and you can build a common kernel which will run on both. Much the same way that you can build a kernel that will run on quite a few PC architectures. Each distinctly different processor has a separate header file directory. There are currently two different major families. One of them I call the ARMO processors, which are the old 26-bit. They are things like the ARM2, the ARM250, and the ARM3. But, as I said, they're now all obsolete, so I won't be looking at them. The ARMv directory contains all the 32-bit processors, like the ARM610, the ARM710, the StrongARM. Generally, these directories contain header files, and the header files are included as a subset of the ARM-specific header files. There are a few cases where they're included from the Arch ARM directory tree, but not a lot of them. Now, this slide is blank, but has the good title, Processor Header Files. Unfortunately, I need to get an X term up, because I'm now going to start talking about those header files. I'm going to be showing you some of them. This unfortunately means that I'm going to have to step back through all the slides when I go back into Magic Point. Right, that's what the 32-bit directory contains. Can you all see that at the back? Somebody's shaking their head. I will see if we can make it bigger. Is it going to? How about that? Too big. Is that okay? Right. This set of header files contains all of the specific information to the 32-bit processors. What we've got here is things like the information about the page tables, the information on the actual page, the geometry of the page tables, how to access user space, various system control functions and bits and pieces like that. First one I'm going to look at is one to do with ARM Assembler, which is the first one there, assembler.h. In order to allow the kernel to be compiled on both 26 and 32-bit architectures, there are various differences between the instruction sets. One of them is the way the process status register is accessed. And this the change means that if you're running in a 32-bit environment, you have to take very, very great care that over a function call, you do not restore the old PSR. Because the old program status register contains things like the processor privilege mode and such like. It's very, very possible that in doing that, you inadvertently switch to, say, user mode or something like that, which isn't very good if you're in the kernel, because then you suddenly find that you can't write to kernel space anymore. I've got a description here of the various macros in this file. They're all included in assembly code, and we've got various different ways of returning from a function call. It depends on exactly the assembler code, and later I can probably show some examples of this, of both of these. But essentially, you can store multiple registers onto the stack using one instruction. And typically, if you're running in a what's called the ARM procedure call standard mode, the registers are typically always saved onto the stack. These are registers which the function call may use to store temporary information and such like. But more importantly, if it calls a function, then what the ARM processor does is it's got a program counter and a link register. The link register is effectively a general purpose register, and it copies the program counter into the link register and then sets the program counter to the destination. That's okay if you only call one function. If you call a sub-function of that, then, oh my God, you've overwritten the link register. And what that sort of thing can cause is the program will work fine. It'll go down into the function, into the sub-function, return from that. And then when it hits the return instruction at the end of that one, it returns back to the same place that the sub-function returned to, because the link register contains that value. So on the ARM, to set up a stack frame, use a store multiple instruction. When you return, you use a load multiple instruction, and between the two processor, the 26 and 32-bit architectures, you must not restore the PSR on the 32-bit. This instruction can touch the PSR, so it's got a macro there called load regs, and depending on which process you're running on, it either adds a flag to it to say yes, restore the PSR, or no. Another one is retinstra. That you can apply to virtually any instruction that writes to the program counter. Again, it affects the PSR, switches the bit on if it needs to be, doesn't set the bit if it doesn't have to be. Assembler code needs to be able to enable and disable interrupts, so I've got a couple of macros for them. And we need to save and restore interrupt, the interrupt status as well. Again, those came out of the fact that the PSR is accessed differently. Got an extra two there, which are user mode and SVC mode. They just switch between the various processor privilege levels. The actual definitions are a bit like that. They're just say macros which expand into the relevant ARM code. The next one that I want to look at is it's stuff that I had to write. Originally, when I did the ARM port, it was done onto the 26-bit architectures. So all through the assembler code, these instructions did write back the PSR when returning from function calls. If I'd run that code on the later processors, then they would have gone absolutely barmy, and we wouldn't have got anywhere. So to keep the support for the 26-bit and the 32-bit, this is the method that I adopted. The macros are heavily optimized so that you can take the old assembler code that was in there, replace it with the macros, and the old code would still end up being the same, and the new code would also be quite efficient as well. Those macros were heavily customized. There are some of them which do similar things but slightly differently, but they are for different circumstances. For instance, it's possible to change the processor privilege level there was a macro in there called mode, and that would give you the previous mode as well as setting the new mode. And that takes about 3 or 4 instructions. Whereas if you use the various bits and pieces to get the current mode and then the macro in there to set the mode, then you're talking about 6 instructions. So these macros have been carefully crafted to reduce the amount of assembler. The next one that I want to look at is the page table bits and pieces. In here are things to do with the cache. As in the x86 architecture, the kernel's got a defined interface for managing the cache, which is basically flush cache all, flush cache mm, flush cache range, and so on and so forth. Again, these allow you to have a granularity of the cache and say, OK, I know I'm going to be touching this region, and I want to flush just that. I should actually define here what I mean by flush, because it's a bit ambiguous. Flush, in this case, means cleaning the data out of a dirty cache and writing it back to memory and invalidating any cache entries. The reason I'm making this point here is that on the ARM, you can do 2 different operations on the cache. You can clean it and you can flush it. If you just flush the cache, then you get rid of any dirty data in the cache as well. It's just totally invalidated and it never gets written back to memory. So this is where these macros come in again. I've got cleaning the cache is basically the act of causing the dirty entries in the cache to be written back to memory. Again, you can do this in various different ways on the ARM. If we're talking about a small region on the ARM, then there's an instruction which you can execute which will flush out 1 cache line at a time. And you can iterate over that to flush out several cache lines. But in the case of the strong ARM, a cache line is 32 bytes long. And if you want to clean the whole cache, and because it's a virtual cache, you need to execute that over the complete 4 gig address space. Obviously, that's not very efficient. Unfortunately, there is no single instruction to flush the whole cache. Sorry, clean the whole cache. The method that was recommended by Digital when they released the strong ARM was to read data out of the memory on 32-byte intervals into the cache. And that causes the cache to say, OK, we need to cache this data. I need to write this cache data back to memory. And indeed, it's possible to do that. Every 32 bytes over the cache size, you can read data and flush out those entries. However, there is a snag to this. If the data is already in the cache that you're reading, then it's possible to still have some dirty entries left in there.
Yeah. If you have a separate data and instruction cache, do you need to do it separately or it's transparent?
The instruction cache, the StrongARM does have separate data and instruction caches. The instruction cache is never written to. So the only case where you would actually need to flush the data there, you never have to clean it because it never gets dirty. The only case you have to flush it is if you're building code on the stack, for example.
How about the MMU if you have separate TLBs? It's the same?
Yes.
MMU.
Yes, there are translation look-aside buffers, and those I will be coming on to shortly. Yes. Luckily, because the instruction cache never gets dirty, you can immediately flush that cache with a single instruction. So I suppose that's one saver that we've had. Anyway, these various cache macros, as you can see there, call through a set of function pointers in what I've called here the processor structure. And the processor structure is set up at boot time depending on the actual processor that you've got in the machine. So when Linux boots on the RISC PC architecture, it says, what type of processor are you? And it says, oh, I'm an ARM710. And the kernel says, okay, we'll put the ARM710 hooks in. And so you can build a kernel that will run on the RISC PC, and no matter what processor you have in there, it'll work. I'm not actually going to go into exactly what all of these macros do. That, I think, would be the subject of a completely separate lecture, which may have already been done, maybe the kernel programming lecture. I don't know, I've only been able to see one lecture so far.
Could you explain why you're using the do while zero structure for each of these?
That's a GCC-ism, I believe.
No, it's a standard C.
Pardon?
It's a standard C tree.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's basically a way of encapsulating that complete block of code. If you've got,
so it won't be optimised in some fashion.
It does actually still optimise it quite well, but I think the reason it's done, but Matthew can probably explain it a lot better. Yes.
That do while zero is just optimized completely away because the compiler can do that very, very easily. It's just a trick.
It doesn't cause any differences in the code generated. But like I was saying, we've got a few extra macros here over the top of the x86 bits and pieces to actually clean the cache in certain circumstances. There are some places where you want to do that. And one of the places that springs to mind is when you're using the debugging functions in the kernel using ptrace. Again, using ptrace and such like is probably the subject of another lecture. The next set that I want to come on to is this set, which are the TLB functions. They're similar to the cache functions, in that they do indeed flush a cache. And again, there are differences between the various processors. I mentioned earlier the ARM architecture reference manual. That does actually define, I think, about 32 different instructions to handle the cache and the TLB. But they are all optional. Consequently, this means that some processor manufacturers may decide, oh, maybe we're not going to implement that one, maybe we'll implement this other one instead. So, again, this has to be vectored through the processor function pointers to select the right set of functions to do the right operations. This is one area which has come up out of the SA1100 port, because the strong arm has the strong arm 110 has an instruction cache and a data cache. The 1100 though has an instruction cache and two data caches. Because it's got two data caches, you've got two sets of instructions to clean the cache. You can clean one of the data caches, or you can clean the other data cache, or you can flush one data cache without flushing the other one, and so on and so forth. So this is the reason why we've got all of these function pointers. And the TLB is exactly the same. Those functions are mostly optional as well. Obviously, if you've got an MMU, you have to support something. Otherwise, you can't change page tables and such like. But this is all pretty generic as far as the specific ARM processor is concerned. The Linux kernel has got support in it for a three-level page table, but like the x86, we've only got a two-level. And that's handled by this set. It basically says that there are 4,096 pointers in the first level page table. If you'd say to it that there is only one pointer in the middle directories, and you get the macros that access that correct, then the compiler does a neat little trick. The whole of the memory management code has got many, many inline functions. What it can do is it can say, okay, well, that's just for I equals 0, I less than 1, I plus plus, say. And it says, well, that for loop only executes once, so don't need to test the condition, don't need the variable, don't need this, don't need that. And suddenly you find that the bits that access the page middle directory have all disappeared. It's quite a neat trick and works very, very well. Otherwise it wouldn't be in the Linux kernel, of course. Yes. Is the three-level page table used on any architecture? Anyway, I'm not going to go into the nitty-gritty of the page table macros, because there's a big, big chunk of them. What I would suggest is, if you want to get into that level, certainly get a copy of the source and effectively read it. That's the best way. There are, as Matthew has said here, there is a thesis that Linus did on it, which may be a good guide. I don't know, I've never read it. But I'm sure that there should be some documentation around somewhere for it. Moving on. The next one that I want to show you is the system macros. These are things for doing from C code, things like enabling interrupts, disabling interrupts, saving the interrupt state, and so on and so forth. This stuff that appears many times in the kernel, in the device drivers and such like. And some of these macros you won't see in the kernel anymore. But they are still used indirectly. As the SMP stuff has been progressing, they've been introducing spin locks. Originally, the kernel used to, on SMP machines, be able to disable all the interrupts on all processors. And they're starting to, and they've got quite a long way away from that now, by using this idea of spin locks. But, again, I'm not going to go into that here. That's a subject for another lecture. But basically, in here, we've got various macros again, things like allowing C code access to the control register so you can effectively say to it, enable the alignment trap handler, which I talked about earlier, or disable it and such like. In fact, what we do on the ARM is to remain compatible with the older architectures and some really strange architectures. We say, as far as the user programs are concerned, we don't particularly want them to fix up, for the kernel to fix up their unaligned accesses. This has caused some controversy because most people are saying, we've got this trap, we ought to be using it in user mode. And other people are saying, no, we shouldn't, because it's going to affect performance quite considerably. I believe that the netbinders have the trap enabled in user mode. And if you look in proc CPU info on the netbinder machines out there, they will actually tell you how many times the trap handler has been used for each instruction type. And I think that typically they've got about 500,000 on the 32-bit, which if you're taking, I'm not sure how long that was over, but it can have a severe performance impact because it's not something that you fix up once, it's something you fix up every time you execute the instruction. So instead of this instruction taking one CPU cycle, it suddenly takes 30, 40 cycles or something. Yes. Yes. The kernel does, when you configure it, you can switch on this alignment trap handler, which will fix up the kernel unaligned traps. This you have to do for certain weird and wonderful networking protocols, like AX25. And to a certain extent, IPX, yes. The problem with AX25 and IPX, I believe, is that you can get an indeterminate number of bytes before the 32-bit quantities come in. What they do on the IP stuff is they use a trick on the Ethernet cards. They say, well, the Ethernet has got a 14-byte header at the start. We know it's 14 bytes. It's always going to be 14 bytes. So rather than starting to write the packet into memory on a word-aligned address, they actually offset it by 2 bytes. That means that when the IP structure comes in, it's word-aligned, which gets around problem machines like the ARM and to some extent the Alpha. I think the Alpha's got more severe problems because it's a 64-bit machine.
It even gets around, there's a performance hit you take on Intel.
Yes. But as I said, generally, if you're running just TCP/IP on the ARM, you can switch that off and the kernel will still run quite happily. I'm not sure how well it will run on the netbinder, though. But so far, my experience has been that It seems to run okay without the Trapphanser. I haven't found any serious problems with it. Pardon? We've got a method of effectively sleeping the processor as well, but unfortunately, fortunately for us, the ARM is such a low power device that it's not really worth doing. And in fact, to actually be able to do it properly, you need external support in hardware to be able to put the processor to sleep. These ARM processors have always been a static design. I remember when I was just after I'd left university, the company was looking at the various processors to put in a device. And they looked at the ARM processor and said, but it doesn't have a sleep mode. Okay. Well, does that really matter with the ARM? It's a low-power device. And it's totally static design. By static design, I mean it's not like your average Intel. You can switch the clock source off to the processor at any time and still go to sleep. So with a bit of external logic, you can handle this. But nevertheless, Linux does have support in there for using this to try and save a bit more power. Even though it's the strong arm has still got the, I believe it's still got the world, the record for the highest MIPS per watt. So if that gives you any clue. I can't remember what the figures are, though. Yes. Quite interestingly, I upclocked my Episode 285 to 287 megs. It originally had a 233 part in it. And attached a temperature probe to it. While it was running, I got it doing various things and noticed that when I actually had it doing something, the processor went down to 25 degrees Celsius in, I think, an ambient of about 22, 23 degrees. But when it was sitting idle, the process temperature rose 5 degrees. Now, the reason for this is may be obvious to some people, may not to others. I think that it's probably going to be obvious to anybody who's worked with ARM processors. And in fact, I've already given some idea of the reason for it. It's all to do with the caches and this clock switch that we have. When the processor's running codes out of cache, it's running at the core clock, which is this 287 or whatever megahertz clock. So the core's running as fast as it possibly can. And when you're sitting in the idle loop, the whole idle loop fits in the cache. So you never have to access external data. So the poor old core is running at 287 or whatever, continuously. So it gets hot. I use hot in a very, very mild sort of way. You may have noticed those pictures of the machines. None of the ARM processors had a heatsink on. That's a very, very good point, which I think influenced the Netwind's development, because one of the things that those guys are after is low power. And the ability not to have a heatsink on the processor with a fan on, and a fan which eventually wears out, and eventually your CPU wears out because it's got too hot and such like. It's got various advantages like that. But unfortunately, that's a bit of a distraction to this lecture. As I said before, the system.h file contains a set of macros to alter the program status register. How am I doing for time? basically, these are bits of inline assembler which manipulate the process state. That one is, again, an extra one that I've added. It gives us a little more performance. It eliminates one instruction. Traditionally, on the Intel, the raw Linux code, you used to end up with two separate macros, a save flags, which saves the current interrupt flags into a register or a variable in the C program, and the following one would be the disable interrupts. To access the program status register and modify it, you need two instructions, at least. The first one up there is the MRS instruction, which reads the current program status register. Then you can use that, the standard ALU operations, to set bits, clear bits, and so on and so forth. And what that macro does there is it masks out the two interrupt enable bits and returns them in temp, and then proceeds to set the interrupt disable bit and writes it back to the current program status register. To actually do that, without that, would involve, the last one was four instructions. This one, you need to both use save flags and a CLI. That's typically what the kernel has done in the past. And you can see there that a save flags involves reading the current status program status register, masking it, and then when you execute the CLI, you need to reread the program status register. But it hasn't changed. So that's the reason why I got the other function in there, the other macro in there, so that you don't have to keep on reading the program status register. Again, these functions are just small and inline, so this is the one that restores the flags. The program status register contains a lot of state about the processor. It contains all of the instruction flags, the carry bit, the zero bit, and so on and so forth. It also contains the privilege level and the interrupt enables. And those have to be preserved when you restore the status. So you're only talking about when you, in the Linux kernel, when you see restore flags, you're only talking about restoring the interrupt state. And this bit of code does it. It just reads the current program status register, clears the two interrupts enable, the two interrupts disable bits, orders back the original flags, and then writes it back. Now, I know I'm running short of time. Timing has never been my strong point. But that is, if you like, the important bits of the processor support. There are, as you can see, there are various other files, but most of them contain just some odd random definitions and such like. The machine architecture support is done in more or less the same way, through the header files. There are various other support files in the Arch ARM directory tree, and I apologise for my timing being so bad. I wish I could get around to showing some of those. Maybe it's a subject for another lecture now. So if anybody is interested, I've probably bored you all to tears, though. I'm going to be around for a number of days after the OLS itself is finished, so just come and find me. And I'll be happy to take you through some of the details if you're interested in that. There are certain people who have contributed work to the ARM project, and I can't miss the NetWinder team. Without them, we wouldn't have the ELF C compiler. The guys did a lot of good work on that, and certainly progressed the ARM port by a significant leap. The other guys are the guys who have added code. Phil Blundell, he's also worked on the compiler. He also puts kernel patches in. He's responsible for the Chalice Cat and a few other of the architectures. Werner there, he's, I'm sure you all know because he's already done his lecture, he's one of the guys porting it onto the GeoFox and Cyan 5. So I think that in the future ARM and ARM Linux is going to start catching on. Certainly the past few years have seen a massive explosion in the interest in ARM Linux. By all means, it started off as a single person effort, and now it's starting to become recognised, I think. Well, Intel have produced a... I don't know if it's publicly available yet. People are shaking their heads. But I think that they have announced that they have been able to produce a 600 megahertz strong ARM. To give you an idea, the current strong ARMs running at... I think it's 275 megs, produced 250 MIPS. These things should probably produce around about, I would guess, about 570, 580 MIPS. And on the ARM, MIPS isn't such a bad rating as on the Intel, because a lot of the instructions do take one cycle. Certainly all the arithmetic instructions are one cycle. Quite a few of the load instructions are, if they're loading from cache. And you've crafted your code very carefully. So certainly the 600 megahertz would be a nice chip to see. Anybody got any questions? Just to finish up. Well, yes?
This is it seems you got involved in this as a hobbyist in the first place.
Yes.
And now we've got commercial interests depending on what you started as a hobby. Has your philosophy about what you think changed?
I'm effectively still doing it in my spare time. I've got other... Unfortunately, I shall say, I've got other interests currently. The company that I actually work for at the moment has got absolutely nothing at all to do with Linux. It's a public address company in the south of England, who make the public address system for the London Underground Jubilee Line extension. It's a safety critical project, and I'm involved in both the hardware and the software on that. It doesn't leave a lot of time for my Linux work, typically doing 50-hour weeks or something. But nevertheless, things still progress. I still release patches roundabouts every week. This gives a good turnover between the release dates of the kernels from Linus and my kernels. Typically, my kernels are, I think, maximum they've been 2 weeks behind Linus, and there have been some problems, but generally, if it's a case of apply the patch, it all works. It's out the next Sunday or Monday.
The reason this is interesting to me is because I keep hearing of Linux things going far beyond whatever anybody ever desired in the first place. And I wonder, will you ever let this go? What conditions?
At the moment, my role is turning into a, if you like, the integrator, because originally it was basically just me writing all the codes and such like, but nowadays it's more Phil Blundell, the Netwinder guys, the Sign 5 guys, they've all got various patches, and at some point, certainly Netwinder is already integrated, and Phil's integrated a lot of his patches in. But there are other things like the SA1100 patches, which have yet to go in, and that's basically my responsibility to put them in and put a new kernel out. Yet in the same way as Linus could, somebody could take over Linus's job, somebody could take over my job. But I think people believe that I'm tending to have quite a good response to patches, and so they don't see any need to take over. But
so I might as well say for people here, we appreciate you doing this. Something that's helping you.
Well, thank you. Certainly on the mailing list, there have been a few emails which are very encouraging, but certainly not as many as I would like. One thing I will say is that during my involvement on the Linux project, it's very, very easy to be lulled into, if you like, a sense of I'm not sure what you would call it, but at times it gets to feel like because everybody else starts developing things, you're working on the same area, somebody else beats you to it. You know, it gets a bit hectic at times, and that's when things start to, as far as the guys on the mailing list are concerned, they see that there's arguments and such like, but generally they look serious, but they normally end up being just eventually just die down and we're all happy friends again.
That's one thing I keep missing in these how to report, how to do things. The people factor is also part of this.
I have actually split up the mailing lists recently. They haven't particularly, it hasn't divided particularly well yet. I've still got to send out emails to try and get more people to move over to whichever list they find the most relevant. But certainly I think that should help so that we get more technically orientated discussions on one list, whereas users' problems are on another list. Traditionally, it's just been one list, and does get very tiring answering the same question over and over again, especially when you've got an FAQ. But I'm not trying to have a dig or anything like that at you guys. Any other questions? I think there was one back there, but well, thank you for listening.